With Sherry Ann, we have this fantastic friendship, too. It's really great. And we have a little bit of a family dynamic going here, and it pretty much mirrors what I grew up with, you know. My my father was the taskmaster, the disciplinarian, which is what I do. I'm the mommy slash daddy. That's right.
Like Mr. Punishment.
Oh, well, you know, and also reward. But Sherry's responsible for the unconditional love, you know.
And the decorative abilities.
Exactly, the heart and the soul, you know, which is what my mother did, and that was her job. You know, she was there for the unconditional love. And it worked for my family, you know, until my mom committed suicide in 81.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest on today's show is the hilarious Jane Lynch. She's currently hosting Hollywood Game Night on NBC, but I've been a fan of hers for a really, really long time. You know her from Best in Show, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Glee, more recently, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and she was also on one of my favorite shows of all time, Party Down. Jane Lynch is truly a comedy legend. She's always so funny and confident and just brought that energy to today's show. So I'm really excited for you all to listen to that. Before we get to the interview, I want to ask again for you to please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It means a lot to me. It helps people find the show. And I really appreciate the feedback that I've been getting already from people about who their favorite episodes have been, who else they want to see on the show, and all of that. So, yeah, let's get right to it. Here's me and Jane Lynch. Have you done a lot of podcasts?
I've done a few in my day.
Yeah.
Let's just put it this way. It won't be my first rodeo.
Okay, that's good. That's good. So, yeah, welcome. Thanks for coming in and doing this.
My pleasure.
So we're just about to start the new season of Hollywood Game Night. This is the sixth season?
Seventh? Is it seventh? Okay, sixth.
No.
Well, I'm hopeful for a seventh.
And I think it's interesting. There's kind of been a trend of these celebrity-hosted game shows that I think seems like there's more and more of them all the time. But you were kind of ahead of the game a little bit on that.
I think we kind of started this fire. We're going to start the fire. We did start the fire. I think so. And, you know, it's a fun gig. So I'll bet they're, you know, like, I'm sure Alec Baldwin loves doing it. And who else is doing one? Anthony Anderson did one. But not that ours has to differentiate itself from anybody, but what's different about our show is that it's more like a party. You know, we have celebrities and civilians, and it's more physical, and it's a game night. It's like you have at your home, and we also ply them with alcohol the minute they get out of their town cars.
That helps.
Yeah, it does.
How did you kind of get involved in it to begin with? What made you want to do it?
Well, Sean Hayes is a friend, and I had him over for dinner one night, and he said, look, I have this thing that I pitched to NBC for a game night, which he's notorious for. Sean is his are amazing.
You've
at
been
his
to
house.
His game nights,
yes. And they were always extravagant affairs where you moved from room to room in his home, and he created all the games himself. And he said, we got six to air, which means we get six episodes to air. Would you like to host it? And I said, no, I can't, because at the time I was in development on a game show, and blah blah blah. And then the next day, I called him and I said, well, how stupid of me. I'm going to let that other thing go and do your show if the offer is still good. And he said, absolutely. So that's how it started.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think is the appeal for people about watching celebrities play funny games
with
each other?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think it's that you feel like you're at a party with these people too.
Yeah.
And the bright, shiny people, the popular people. And then, of course, we have two civilian folks who are always bright and shiny themselves, who, you know, you can kind of vicariously live through, like, oh, I could be at a party with Dax Shepard too.
Yeah, I mean, I think between your show and, you know, obviously what Jimmy Fallon has been doing on his show is, you know, he does the same kind of thing where he puts these, you know, unexpected combinations of people together to play a game. There is something that people find very appealing about that, just watching, I guess, watching celebrities do something that they're not used to watching them do.
Right. And, you know, everybody's unguarded and it's basically spontaneous. And there's, you know, playing a game is a great equalizer. You know, you're all on the same team and you're all doing the same goofy stuff. And there's really no stakes. I mean, there's $25,000, which is a pretty nice payday for our contestants. But
and the celebrities aren't eligible for that, right?
No. They do get to, they are not eligible for that. They do get to donate if they make it to the final round and their civilian wins. They get that amount of money donated to their favorite charity.
Right,
so it's a great thing.
Yeah. Were there game shows that you particularly enjoyed when you were growing up?
I remember Match Game.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love
Match
Game.
That's what Alec Baldwin is doing, new one, right?
Yeah. Match Game, Gene Rayburn. Remember, mm-hmm. he was the host of that, and he had Charles Nelson Reilly and Brett Summers and Paul Lynde. Was it Paul? I forget. Who was the third? Oh, Richard Dawson, who I guess was a pain in the ass, what I understand. And they were very happy to see the backside of him when he went to the Family Feud.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember spending an entire evening watching, just recently watching on YouTube, episodes of Matt, because they were hilarious. They were so much fun. And from what I understand, and this was more than just myth, they drank through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. They would do 7 shows a day or something crazy like that. And by the 7th show, they're all plastered in there. It looks like they're drinking water under there. And no, it was like straight gin. Brett Summers was such a funny... I don't think Brett Summers was famous for anything other than being on Match Game and married to Jack Klugman.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe all we know about Brett Summers, but she was something.
Yeah. I know you don't drink. So is it weird to watch, people drink when you're hosting the show?
No, I'm the designated driver, so to speak. And I'm very happy to be that.
Yeah. So you mentioned you had been developing another game show idea.
Yeah.
I also remember hearing that you were developing a daytime talk show at some point.
Yeah, I didn't. I actually it was a more of a variety show. It wasn't really a talk show, but somehow it got out there that I was doing a talk show. But you know what? I would love to do a talk show.
Yeah.
I think that would be a fun thing to do. It's a little boring to just like you talk to funny people and we talk about comedy. I don't want to talk about somebody's next. I'm promoting Hollywood Game Night, but I'd like to have more substantive conversations.
You know?
It doesn't have to be about like rocket science or the reality of time and space. It could be anything. I think I'm going to have to sit down and write that out. What that would be.
I mean, that's what's great about podcasts is they can be kind of more substantive than some of these. A lot of the talk shows, at least, whether it's late night shows or Ellen, or they're very funny and very entertaining, but it's seven minutes and you're out.
Right, and they're formulaic too.
Yeah,
and and James Corden kind of really expand, and so Seth Meyers is great too.
Yeah,
they're doing great. Seven Allen has been great for what 15 years now.
Yeah,
yeah.
What did Ellen's sort of trajectory mean for you when you sort of were watching that?
That's a real good question because it made my being a gay person in Hollywood and non. No-brainer and not a problem at all.
Yeah.
Because she basically took one for the team, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I know obviously, if you asked her when she was a little girl, do you want to be a gay icon who, blazes a trail for everybody else? I doubt she would have said yes. But she did it. She stood there and took it and did it and was honest. And, within 3 years of doing that, she's the spokesperson for American Express. She's got her own talk show, and women from all over the Midwest come flock to her show and dance with her. And she's right up there with Oprah, and I think that's a great thing. So yeah, I'm great. I'm indebted to her for that because I didn't have to do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I just got to be an actor playing a role, which I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, I mean, you were working, before she came out and before you came out. So was there fear involved in that?
Yeah, in abstract. I didn't even really have a coming out.
Yeah.
I just kind of showed up and just didn't say I wasn't. In abstract, like laying in bed at night when I was like, 25, going, what will I do if they find out? Oh my God, I haven't even told my parents yet. And will I be able to do what I want to do? And there were some worries about that, but for the most part, no. I just, I was doing, I was hanging out with a group of people, and we did sketch comedy together, and it didn't matter that I was gay or anybody else was straight. It just didn't matter. And it hasn't mattered my whole life.
Yeah.
And that's why it breaks my heart for especially kids out there. It matters, and they're keeping a secret deep within themselves that they're afraid will be exposed, and that breaks my heart.
Yeah. Well, what's kind of fascinating about your career is that your big breakout role was as a gay character.
I know,
in
and
Best
I never
in
even
Show.
Thought of that. I never even thought about it at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh my God, this is Christopher Guest movie. People are going to know who I am after this, or at least people who love Christopher Guest movies.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people I care about.
Yeah.
And I'm playing a gay person. Will they think I'm a gay person? That didn't even cross my mind. And so I'm glad for that.
Yeah. So the story of how you got that film is pretty interesting. So yeah. It had something to do with a Frosted Flakes
yes.
commercial. Can you tell that
sure.
that story?
Well, 1999 was a very good year for me in terms of television commercials. I probably did 7 or 8 nationals, and this
yeah.
was back in the day.
That's
when
big.
You made a lot of money for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like that. What is it? Over $100,000 for each of them. I mean, stretched out over a few years. But I was kind of sitting pretty. Not that this has anything to do with meeting Christopher Guest, just by
yeah.
to tell you that I had 1 year where I made a lot of commercials, and the Kellogg's Frosted Flakes was one of them.
Hi, I'm Steve. This is Kathy.
Oh, and we just love Kellogg's Frosted Flakes.
We come here every day, you know, just hoping he'll make an appearance of some sort. Excuse me, could you send out Tony when you see him?
Tony who?
Oh, come on. Frosted Flakes are about so much more than just great taste. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that, and then there's Tony, you know. Mm-hmm. Then there's the frosting, and then there's Tony.
All right, take a picture.
Okay, got it.
Okay,
he looks
good.
Different.
I think that's a woman.
You're right.
Yeah.
They're great!
And I showed up for the callback for that, and it said, director Christopher Guest. And I was very excited because I was a huge fan
yeah.
of Goffman. I was excited and almost wanted to walk out
yeah.
at the same.
And who knew he was directing commercials?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it turns out he was, and I don't know how he's doing it now, but he was directing a commercial like a day. I mean, the guy was prolific.
Wow.
Anything you laughed at on television
yeah.
was
yeah, I don't
directed.
Think a lot of people know that.
Yeah, he was directed by Christopher Guest, and when he does a commercial, he won't do it unless he gets the agreement that he has final say on everything
mm-hmm.
and that the client isn't even allowed on set. They're kind of in a remote location with the monitor. So anyway, went to the callback, and there he is, and being his Christopher Guest self, which is, you know, not very effusive. And
mm-hmm.
I actually found it comforting
yeah.
because inside I had a lot of anxiety, and it was just really comforting and kind of cool. And we improvised a little bit, and then I got the role. And at lunch, while we were shooting this Kellogg's Frosted Flakes commercial, he said, you know, I do movies. And I pretended to be like, oh, really? I said, yeah, I know. I really loved Waiting for Guffman. He said, well, maybe we'll do a movie someday. And I said, I would love that. So that made
yeah.
me feel great. And then within 3 months, I ran into him at a restaurant. And he said, oh, yeah, you. He said, well, I am casting a movie. Come to my office. So I thought I was going to his office for like an audition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically just, we small talked. And then he said, so this is the part you would play if you want to do it. And I just have to talk to Eugene Levy at
yeah.
the time. And I have to talk to my producer, Karen Murphy. And then I'll call you at about 5:00 today. And he called me and said, hey, you wanted to do it? And I said, yes.
Do you know if the part was at all based on you? Or was
no,
this
it wasn't.
It was an existing part that he was just trying to cast?
It was an existing part that he was trying to cast. And he had Catherine O'Hara and Jennifer Coolidge
mm-hmm.
as a couple. And then he decided he wanted Eugene and Catherine to play
yeah.
The couple with Winky. And so he was looking for somebody else. And mm-hmm. so...
Yeah,
I ended up the lucky recipient of that somebody else position.
So, and his style of working, and it must have been similar almost on the commercial in some ways,
yeah, exactly
is very
same.
Unique. So can you just talk about what that was like to kind of go into that world and
sure.
and do that new style? And I know you came from Second City, so you had improv background
right,
as
but
well.
This was different.
And yeah.
this was different in that there's no script. What he told me, he said, just like we did with the commercial, there's no script. There's an outline
mm-hmm.
and there's no rehearsal. So we show up and we shoot. And he said, so any work you have to do for yourself, you do ahead of time. And he said to me, he said, look, I don't do anything. I just kind of let the camera roll and I do what I do. And I was like, well, I'm going to be a little more prepared than that. and I spent a lot of time working on this character. He gives you some given circumstances of who they are. And I filled it in for myself. And it turns out I love working this way.
Yeah.
John Michael Higgins says you pack heavily for this. You over. flavor pack. And you, I never prepared for a character the way I prepare for this. In order to improvise something, you have to be very, very familiar with the person you're playing and their relationship and how they view the world and their opinion on things. Like, I used to read the paper to myself in the mirror as Christy Cummings. That was I'd opine about what I just read from the point of view of Christy Cummings.
That's
kind of how I cemented it into my person. And you just show up and literally, truly, the cameras, everything's set up. Mm-hmm. He says, you're going to sit here and you're going to sit here. And Jennifer and I did talk. Coolidge and I did talk.
Did you know Jennifer Coolidge before this?
No, I knew her peripherally.
Yeah.
But we had dinner before leaving for Vancouver. And then we hung out a lot in Vancouver. And we talked a lot about what we were going to do. But it was, it was still very improvised. We didn't have, like, our lines and everything. We kind of talked about our relationship. And we laughed a lot. And we talked about the porno we watched the night before. And she got it free in her room for some reason, so she would share the scenarios with me. He says, you sit here, you sit there, and he runs the camera, and he shoots the master, mm-hmm. and it goes on forever. You think, well, I don't have anything more to say now. And you hear the camera, I better keep talking. And then he says, cut. And he says, very good. Not like he means it at mm-hmm. all. It was just kind of like, very good. And then he brings the camera in a little. And then he keeps bringing the camera in closer and closer. And he'll get more specific, like, do that part about this and do that part about that. And you don't need to do that part anymore because I got it and blah, blah, blah. Because mm-hmm. he's editing it in his head in a way, even though he takes like a year to edit it, to put it all together. But he kind of knows what he wants right after you do the master, mm-hmm. you know, and he's keeping an eye on the story as well, making sure all the plot points are covered and stuff like that.
Did you have, I mean, obviously it was a big deal when you got the part, but did you have any idea what this movie would mean, you know, for your career?
I had a hope in a sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. I love this kind of work. I love working this way. I love ensemble comedy, and mm-hmm. I hope that meant that I would work more in ensemble comedy, and indeed I did. I ended up being in some really great funny movies with some really great funny people.
Coming up, Jane Lynch talks about what it was like to reunite with her old Second City pal Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and reveals the origin of my favorite line from that movie. Yeah, I mean, another of my favorites is The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which came about 5 years later, I think. And I heard that part was originally written for a man.
It was, when I kind of have a history of that back to high school when I played the king in the Princess and the Pea story. And it was written for a man. And Nancy Walls, who is a wonderful actress and married to Steve Carell, said, you have a lot of, and because Steve was a producer on this, mm-hmm. it was his character, and he's a writer on it, and she said, you have a lot of men in your movie. Maybe you should cast a woman. And he said, why don't you see Jane for this? Because I know them from Chicago.
We call
it Second City at the same time. And so I auditioned for it, and we improvised the whole thing about me deflowering him.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me the role.
Yeah, so the I'll haunt your dreams is a line that's very memorable.
Judd Apatow whispered that directly into my ear.
I understand you have a girlfriend.
Yeah, kind of seeing somebody.
Very happy for you.
Thanks, she's great.
Are you still a virgin?
Oh, you know, I don't really talk about my personal life.
You're a virgin?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. The door's always open, so to speak.
Great. Thank you.
I'm very discreet. But I'll haunt your dreams.
Yeah. How would you compare the way that Judd works to the way Christopher Guest works? Because they're very different, but I imagine there are some similarities.
Oh, Judd was like a coach. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like an encouraging coach. And you're like sitting on the bench, like all the smart tech stuff, we were mm-hmm. called in every day, even if we weren't on the call sheet or in the scenes. And he would say, you know, Seth, get in there, or Jane, get in there, Steve, get in there, do something, say something. And that's where I did my Guatemalan love song that I sang to Steve.
Where did that come from, that idea?
I don't know where it came from, but it's a dialogue from a Spanish level one mm-hmm. in high school that I remembered. Mm-hmm. And you know how things just kind of come to you. And I was sitting on the bench, as it were, and I started thinking of that in my mind. And I thought, maybe I'll do it in this scene. And I was a little nervous about doing it. You never know how this stuff is going to go over. It made me laugh in my head. And so I just told Steve before we started, I said, I'm probably going to sing a little song to you. And he said, okay.
So you worked with Steve at Second City?
We were there at the same time, but in mm-hmm. different companies, different touring companies.
Yeah. So what was your experience like at Second City?
It was good. You know, we toured a lot. It was kind of boot camp for sketch comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, you went by the seat of your pants a lot. You learned how to react on your feet, and not a lot of improvising for the touring. That we did improv set at the end of the set show, but for the most part it was doing the best of Second City. We would, you know, pull scenes from the past and perform them. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like being on one of the stages in Chicago where you create a show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're using material that other people have developed.
Exactly.
Did you like that, or did you want developing your own stuff?
Well, and I never desired developing my own stuff. Mm-hmm. Although I wanted to be on one of the stages, that would just seem like the, you know, kind of the brass ring, and I didn't. I ended mm-hmm. up just doing the touring company. But I like doing set stuff. I like improvising and being free within the confines. Like mm-hmm. I like bouncing around in a cage, bouncing around freely in a cage that I built for myself. I don't, that pure freedom of like, you can do anything you want makes me just, you know, want to take a nap.
Mm-hmm. Obviously for a lot of people at Second City or the Groundlings out here, Saturday Night Live is a big goal. Was that something that you thought about or kind of went after in any way?
I never thought I would get anything like that. And it never crossed my mind that mm-hmm. I would be able to do that.
But you must have worked with people who did.
Yeah. Yeah. Tim Meadows was in our touring company and... God, I can't think of. Stephen Colbert.
Right. Yeah.
And he, of course, wasn't on SNL, but he's obviously doing quite well.
He's Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, but he's Stephen Colbert. Yeah. And then I ended up hosting, which was great. Saturday Night Live. So that was, never thought something like that would happen.
What was that experience like?
Oh, it was the best. You know, I was really, really nervous because it's a live show. And at the rehearsal, we do a full dress rehearsal with an audience before we go on the air at like 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, something like that. And I realized in the middle of that, oh, this is a sketch show. I know how to do a sketch show. And I totally relaxed. I was like, I know this. I don't even have to worry about my lines because they're on a card right there.
Yeah.
And I completely relaxed. I'm so glad we had that, you know, that run through.
Yeah, maybe that's why they do that for one reason, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the thing that probably got you to host Saturday Night Live was Glee,
yes,
which was obviously a huge deal when mm-hmm. when it came out. And when at that time you were on one of my favorite shows of yours, was Party Down.
Oh yeah,
which I loved.
Isn't that great.
And you ended up leaving Party Down to do Glee. So what was that? Was that an easy decision? Was that a hard decision?
Well, it kind of was made for me. It was Party Down was in second position to Glee. So I knew it was going to happen.
Meaning that it was the way the contracts work. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would be going to. Mm-hmm. to Glee. So when it was picked up, I was happy and everything. But boy, that first, I think they were 10 shows with Party Down was truly a peak experience.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. And we were doing it in kind of a really safe space. Nobody knew about it. Nobody knew Stars was even doing mm-hmm. a comedy show. And the network executives were never there. It was really just, we had one writer, his name is Dan Embaum, and he was amazing. So we did a combination of where he would write for us, and then people like Martin Starr can never say anything that's written for him. He has to say it his own way. And some people were more improvisational than others. And I just loved it. We loved each other, and it was a rarefied experience.
Yeah, it's a very unique show that I think a lot of people, it obviously didn't have a huge audience at the time.
Not
I think probably
time.
More people have seen it since. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend anyone who hasn't seen it to go back and watch because it's everyone, you'll recognize everybody on
exactly,
it.
Exactly, because everybody's kind of on the way to a network show.
Adam Scott.
Adam Scott, Ken
Parks
Marino,
and Rec,
Martin Starr before
Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm. and Lizzie Kaplan before mm-hmm. the sex show.
Yeah, was that Masters of Sex.
Sex?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. So that was pretty great. Who am I missing?
Ryan Hansen.
Yeah, Ryan Hansen.
Oh, he's
before
great
Ryan
too.
Hansen does solves crime on TV. Yeah, he's amazing.
That's mm-hmm. great. But then obviously you went to Glee, and that became a massive hit.
Yes.
In the same sense of, did you know what Best in Show would be, what would mean for you? Did you have any idea what Glee would be?
I didn't know exactly what it would mean or be, but I knew it would be a hit. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it would be huge.
Yeah.
I didn't know, but I knew that, the power of like music and musical theater, mm-hmm. it cannot be denied.
Was that
in
a
our
love
culture.
Of yours
oh,
at
yeah.
that time?
Big time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love musical theater, but, it's a passion for people. I don't think I've ever met anybody who's like, I kind of like musical theater. It's either I don't care for it or I love it.
Yeah.
So I think that, I thought we would corner the market on people who love it. Mm-hmm. And indeed we did, and then some.
Yeah.
And, it was one of those shows where if you would all feel like an underdog, and we all do, especially in high school, and where high school is, Ryan always uses high school as a microcosm mm-hmm. for life.
Yeah.
And
Ryan Murphy.
Yeah.
What were your kind of first impressions of him now before he has taken over Hollywood completely?
Yeah, right. Well, I met him doing Popular, his show Popular, which is also a high school show. And he gave me an amazingly crazy part. I played three different characters. I played a serial killer, a teacher, and a travel agent with sandals who did sandals cruises. So it was really crazy and fun. I adored him. And so when he asked me to do Glee, of course, that would be. In fact, Sue Sylvester wasn't even in the pilot.
Oh, yeah.
It was Kevin Reilly, who was the head of Fox at the time, said, we need a villain in this.
Mm.
And from what I understand, Ryan said, it will be the cheerleading coach, and she will be called Sue Sylvester, and she will be played by Jane Lynch. I think he said that. I like to think he did.
In the moment.
yeah, right.
Well played, sir. I underestimated you. All right. Here's what happens now. I'm going to head on down to my condo in Boca, brown up a bit, get myself back into fighting shape. And then I'm going to return to the school even more hell-bent on your destruction. Get ready for the ride of your life, Will Schuster. You are about to board the Sue Sylvester Express. Destination? Horror.
It's interesting to make the decision to make the villain a teacher as opposed to another student is kind of interesting.
Yeah, where she has kind of
dynamic,
this power.
Yeah.
Sue Sylvester is very much like Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah?
She just fights to the point where you one indignity after another, one breaking law over here, breaking a law over there, you can't keep up with it. And then, she gets forgiven and she does the same thing over and over again. But she does have some redemptive moments that Donald Trump doesn't
have. Yeah, I would say so. That was sort of the most interesting thing about her was when they started to reveal some humanizing.
Yeah, the soft underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we don't see that as much from
Trump. Not at all. Well, I think that's the difference between just plain narcissism and then sociopathic narcissism.
So did you enjoy playing that character and getting to develop him? Because that's probably I don't know if it is, but probably the longest time you've ever spent with one character.
Yes, indeed it was.
How did you like that, being able to kind of keep developing it, keep revealing new layers?
I loved it. And Ian Brennan is the writer who wrote most of my lines. And he's a Chicago boy, and I'm a Chicago girl. I'm a couple of decades older than he is, but we kind of have the same reference level. I don't know how to explain it, but we have the same kind of extreme, violent sense of humor. So I loved how he would just push Sue to such extremes. She was so mean sometimes, just so awful. And then he also, in her moments, her redemptive moments, she's quite human. But I remember in the pilot, I bring coffee for everybody. For some reason, I'm bringing people coffee. I can't remember why. it was self-serving on some level, I'm sure. And I hand it out, and this is yours, and this is yours, and this is mine. I like mine scalding. And that kind of set the... the tone for Sue Sylvester was the extremes.
Yeah. Did you have much of a say in what she was like as a character, or did it really come from the page?
It came from the page, yeah. They were very good with it.
Yeah. I think she is one of those kind of iconic TV characters that runs the risk of you getting, you know, so associated with this character that it's hard for people to see you as someone else. Yeah. Thinking of, you know, Henry Winkler always talks about this with the Fonz, that it took him a long time to kind of break out of that. Was that ever a concern for you?
No, it wasn't a concern, and I don't, you know, unless it's behind my back, people saying it. I think it's less and less of something than back in the day when Happy Days was the number one show on ABC. I remember those days very well. There were fewer shows, and there were fewer iconic characters. And I can see how television actors just did television and movie actors just did movies. And I can see how someone might get stuck. But these days, no.
Yeah.
I don't see it. And I never crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm. Another recent project that I really enjoyed you in was Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Mm-hmm. And you kind of came in towards the end of the first season, and then we're in a couple episodes in the second season. That your character is a very unique character, Sophie Lennon.
Yeah.
In that, is she based on somebody? Did you what kind of preparation did you do to kind of figure out who that character is?
Well, the comedy, you know, she's like a borscht belt comedian, completely different from Midge.
Yeah, and set up as this sharp contrast in style.
And she comes in, she wears a fat suit, and she's the ugly housewife from Queens. And you can just hear the drum, ba-doom, chick, in the back of her jokes, and she's very old school. And then, of course, the actress herself, Sophie Lennon, is very smug and severely insecure and a bit of a diva. So the contrast of those two characters, of course, was just really exciting, and it was written very well. But the comic, I go to Phyllis Diller, Todie Fields. Remember Todie Fields? I don't remember. You might be too young for Todie
Phyllis Fields. Diller, I know.
Yeah, and a little bit of Joan Rivers in there, too. Mm-hmm. So definitely inspired by, my love of that kind of comedy. And then the kind of smug, self-satisfied actress. Did you ever see The Sound of Music?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the Baroness?
Mm, yeah.
The actress's name was Eleanor Parker. So I'm doing kind of this woman thinks she's Eleanor Parker.
Yeah.
She's really not as classy or as stable. It's like she appeared to be. But anyway, that's how I saw myself. The look and everything was more kind of like an aging Eleanor Parker.
Speaking of different styles, Christopher Guest, Judd Apatow, this is a very scripted show in very specific language and all that. So, and very fast at times. And that's Amy Sherman Palladino style.
Exactly.
So was that, did that present any challenges for you in terms of mastering the language?
My character doesn't speak that quickly. She's more, she's very, so very pompous.
Mm-hmm.
And every word is weighted. And if she does speak quickly, it's never at a clip like you hear Midge speak. So she's much more deliberate in her speech and slows everything down.
Mm. And I heard you might be returning for season 3.
I am. Almost the whole season.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
Yes.
So anything, have you started shooting yet?
We have, and I'm not allowed to say anything.
Anything. but you play maybe a bigger role this season than
some,
past.
Yeah, there's some fun stuff in store for Sophie Lennon this season, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, that character kind of butting up against this new time in comedy and the divide.
Yes,
there.
And she's more of a kind of an observational comic, Midge is, and she's not so much about, and you know, it's kind of it's biographical, but she doesn't have a gimmick, and she's basically herself up there, and she's observational. She talks about politics, and he gets a little dark, but she's, it's really funny stuff. She's kind of doing what guys have been doing for years in stand up, and she's standing up and saying, "Well, I'm going to do that too."
Mm. Just going back a little bit, what were sort of your earliest comedy memories? Who were the people that you loved when you were growing up in outside of Chicago?
Barbara Streisand. I loved Funny Girl. I thought she was I remember going to the movie and just thinking it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. Let's see. Well, Phyllis Diller. You know, mm-hmm. I remember seeing her on The Tonight Show. I loved Eve Arden. I thought she was hilarious. And Kay Ballard. They did a show called The Mothers-in-Law, that short-lived show, but oh my goodness, I thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen, and I loved Eve Arden and all sorts of stuff from Grease all the way back to the movies that she did in the 40s and 50s, and I loved that dry kind of, you know, where I don't know how to explain it, but if you ever see Eve Arden, you'll see what I mean. And oh gosh, what else?
And at what point did you think of yourself? Did you think this is something that I could do? This is something I want to do.
I don't think there was a moment where I didn't think that.
Yeah,
it just always.
As long as you can remember.
Yeah, as long as I can remember. Yeah.
And what did you? How did you first kind of approach it
know, doing plays in school, mm-hmm. and my brother and I loved Saturday Night Live and the Carol Burnett Show. Mm-hmm. Carol, of course, being a someone I was really inspired by, and my brother and I would act out the scenes. You know, we would take, this is like back in the Stone Age, we didn't have DVRs, of course, or even videotape, but we would tape it on a regular cassette tape, mm-hmm. you know, just the audio.
The audio, yeah.
Yeah, and we'd play it back all week long and act it out, and we loved doing that. And then, you know, getting into plays in school, and I was always, you know, was I the class clown? Occasionally. Just doing plays and knowing that that's what I wanted to do, and studying it in college, getting into the theater program after starting out in mass communications, which my mother said, well, that's theater adjacent. You'll get a job at the end of 4 years. And then without telling anybody, I switched my major to theater and started doing plays.
Did your parents worry about you that you weren't going to succeed?
A little bit. You know, I was the middle child, so I didn't get the attention that the oldest and the youngest did. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, Jane's fine. We have to worry about these two extremes over here.
Yeah.
I didn't get like that kind of helicopter parent thing, but they were. They didn't think I'd make a living. And my mother said, you should learn to type. It's a wonderful thing to fall back on. And I see you teaching, she used to say. Mm. And I said to her once after I'd done Shakespeare in the Park in Chicago, and she said, you were fantastic. It was so good. But, you know, I still see you teaching. And I stopped her. We were taking a walk. You can never say that to me again. And she said, oh, okay. And she didn't.
Was there a moment or something that you did that they saw that they thought, you know, now you've made it?
Yeah, when I did The Fugitive.
Yeah.
The movie that was, you know, I'm from Chicago and it was shot in Chicago. And
that was your earliest film role?
Vice Versa was my earliest, mm-hmm. with Judd Apatow and, not Judd Apatow, Judge Reinhold.
Mm, yeah.
And Fred Savage. He was never Freddie. Fred Savage. So that was the first one. But the scene with, I did a scene with, Harrison Ford, and it wasn't comedy or anything, mm-hmm. like that. It was straight up.
Yeah.
I was playing a scientist, and they were like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, sharing the screen with Harrison Ford is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, pretty big deal. Yeah, I remember I was at my uncle's funeral. And my aunt said, I went up to her, and I said, I'm so sorry. She said, what's Harrison Ford like?
And what'd you say?
I said, he's lovely. He's wonderful.
So just in terms of sort of what's next for you, you know, you're doing Hollywood Game Night, obviously. Mm-hmm. Are there other projects on the horizon that you're excited about or things that you want to do?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I guess that's about it. I kind of take what rolls in at my feet or not, you know.
Yeah. How many films have you done with Christopher Guest at this point?
Four. Let's see. Now we almost counted Waiting for Guffman. I was not in Waiting for Guffman. I loved it, though. Yeah, four.
Is there a chance that you think there's another one on the horizon?
You know, it's up to him. You mm-hmm. never know. I was surprised that we did the last one, Mascots.
Yeah.
I was thrilled.
That was on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you would want to if he came
absolutely.
To you and work with all those people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean you've worked with a lot of he kind of has a company, so you kind of work with the same people
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gotten to know all those guys pretty well.
Yeah, they're all actors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's they're not like stars or mm-hmm. they don't, you know, they are. I mean they're famous and everything, but they kind of, this group of actors kind of remind me or make me think this is what British actors are like. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not very concerned about the Hollywood trappings. They don't have them. Like, I love British comedies and British detective dramas. And I imagine that they're kind of like the Christopher Guest unofficial comedy group. They've got families. They take it seriously, and then not too seriously, and that nobody has any, nobody's throwing fits or staying in their trailers or demanding, things that, they want to have billing. It's favored nations. We all get paid the exact same. And we, it's alphabetical order. The names are listed in. So it's, there's none of that,
Yeah, and you guys goofiness. Kind of, you sent up all that Hollywood stuff in for your consideration.
Yeah.
Was that fun to kind
it
of
was.
Delve into that?
Yeah,
world?
That was really great. I think that came as the result of the song in Mighty Wind was nominated.
Mm.
And our movies have been nominated like for Golden Globes and stuff like that. And the fascination that Chris and Eugene have with like this whole campaign. Mm. That's when the campaign started. Remember, it was Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
Weinstein started it. The ads and kind of this trying to get word of mouth and, in order to get an award.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were commenting on that because that was brand new back in like 2005.
Yeah. Coming up, Jane shares what she learned from acting opposite Meryl Streep in Julie and Julia. So what I like to do on this show is kind of go through a few sort of moments or highlights of your career and get you to say sort of the first memory that comes to mind or a story or something like that.
Okay.
So the first one is there was this show, The Real Live Brady Bunch, that you were in, that is kind of a storied show. So can you explain what that was and what that experience was like?
Jill and Faith Soloway, Jill Soloway of Transparent fame and Faith as well also writes on the show. They're good friends from Chicago, and our friend Mick Napier opened a theater called The Annoyance Theater, and he wanted to have a show in there Monday through Monday in order to pay the rent. So we took Wednesday nights. He said, do whatever you want to do. And we were like, well, what would be fun? Why don't we do actual episodes of The Brady Bunch? And Jill would transcribe them right off the TV. And we'll, charge people $5 to come in and let them drink and smoke in the theater, which was just totally against all the laws. But we did it anyway. And the first night, our first episode, we all went to thrift stores and we found 70s clothes. And the theater was a mess. It was filthy and full of mold and everything, and people smoking and drinking. It was just a fire trap. But the first night, we were on the roof of the thing having pizza and beer before we were going to perform. And we looked down and there was a line all the way around the block.
How did that happen?
Word got out and people wanted to see it. The Brady Bunch was kind of a phenomenon for all of us, maybe a dirty secret for all of us in our generation, too, that we loved it and took comfort in it and also made fun of it because it was so, corny and but we all loved it.
And you played?
I played Carol Brady.
Mm-hmm. And Andy Richter was in it,
I believe? He was Mike Brady. Yeah. He was my husband and my beloved. And Faith is a musician, and she did all the music, the interstitial music that they would play. And then we put in our own little commercials. Anyway, it turned out to be a pretty big hit. And what's his name? Sherwood Schwartz actually flew out to Chicago without anybody. He's the creator of the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, yeah.
Without anybody knowing, and showed up at our Johnny Bravo episode, and with the idea, his lawyer said, "We got to close this thing down," and he said, "Well, I just want to see what it is." And so he showed up, and we recognized him, and we put the spotlight on him, and people were bowing to him, and he was like, "You kids are great," and he charged us $1 a show to use his scripts, and he started sending us the scripts, and
so that she wouldn't have to, so that Jill wouldn't
have
to type them.
Jill wouldn't have to type them out, and we think that we know that that gave him the inspiration to do the movies after that, because he saw it was Living for Another Generation, and he was smart enough to make fun of himself too.
Yeah, the movies were kind of were pretty interesting the way they self-referential, or kind of updating the
Oh, Jan. Yeah, in fact, oh God, what's her name who played Marcia in that? Oh God, she's married to Ben Stiller.
Oh. Christine Taylor.
She was a little girl when we were doing these. She was very young, and she was 19 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when our Marcia, Becky Thayer, went on vacation, she played our Marsha.
Wow.
And she was so young.
Before
and
the films.
Yeah, before the films.
That's so funny.
Yeah, and she was so cute.
So another of your early TV jobs was Two and a Half Men.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that experience like, you know, working with Charlie Sheen, who was a character?
Yes, first of all, he was a pro. He carried that show, and he had, oh my God, he had so many lines. And he was just a really great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I started out as a therapist for the kid, mm-hmm. and then I think I had a session with John Cryer's character, Alan,
mm-hmm.
and then had a session with Charlie, and that became kind of the thing. Yeah, so we did three or four episodes every year.
What do you remember about your first late night appearance? I believe what I found was that it was on Conan's Tonight Show, his short-lived when Conan was hosting the Tonight Show.
Well, it was probably fun because Andy was there, so it made me feel comfortable.
Do you remember that at all?
What I do remember about that is I told the story of when we were doing the Brady Bunch, and I went back to Chicago to do a play, and I gave Andy my car out here in LA, and he racked up like $600 worth of parking tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, you have to pay these. And he sent me a $600 check in NBC stationery saying, hey, I got a job. I'm writing for Conan O'Brien. So we told that story. And he started out as a writer and then became his sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I kind of remember that. Yeah.
What about in 2009, winning your first Emmy for Glee? I saw that Stephen Colbert, who we mentioned, actually presented it to you.
He gave it to me.
So that must have been kind of a nice moment.
It was really nice. Yeah, it was a really cool thing to have him give me that award. Yeah, it was a big deal. It was just the greatest.
And the Emmy goes to Jane Lynch, Glee.
Thank you so much. This is outlandish. I want to thank my parents on the south side of Chicago for raising us. Yeah, south side! For raising us to the sounds of musical theater and being so unintentionally hilarious. And I want to share this with my fellow nominees. I am a fan of all of you. And I love being an actor. I love being an actor among actors. I love being an ensemble. And though I rarely identify myself as anything, I'm Buddhist in that way, although I'm not a Buddhist. They do seem like a very calm people.
I just watched your acceptance speech, and you're cracking jokes, and you seem very composed.
Oh, well, that's
compared to some people who got up there and, you know, are all over the place. So did you feel composed, or
yeah,
how did you feel?
Yeah, I did feel composed. Yeah, I did. I've never kind of lost my shit over getting an award. Which they're lovely. I mean, it's a great thing, but yeah, I know. It's nice.
And then a couple years later, you hosted the Emmys.
I did. Yes.
So what was that experience? What stands out from that experience?
Oh boy, the nerves and I was nervous. And then I realized, just like I did with SNL, yeah, it's live and everything, but basically, it's about an opening number and then reading off the teleprompter.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about. And once you're done with the opening number, it's clear sailing.
Yeah, and you were singing and dancing in the opening number. So
yes, a lot of it was pre-taped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had to do that. Oh, yeah, I was very nervous for that, the live stuff. But once that was done, I was like, oh, this is easy.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. We mentioned SNL, hosting SNL. Were there any other moments maybe from the week? Because you spend a whole week there.
Yeah.
That stand out when you think back to that?
Well, I just was amazed at the wealth of material that is presented for just one week, and then we end up like throwing out these great things.
Yeah.
Just they're gone. You know, they get cut like that. Mm. You have to be used to, and I think the cast has to be used to. You know, they say you kill a lot of babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what I noticed. I love doing, in fact, speaking of Sophie Lennon from Amazon, I think the tender beginnings of that character, the comic character, was in a game show that I did with Kristen Wiig, where she played, it was like Match Game, and she played this old-time movie star who said, I soak my face with mayonnaise. And then I did kind of a Phyllis Diller, ha! Kind of a character, and I think that might have been the tender beginnings of Sophie Lennon.
You were the roast master for the Roseanne, the Comedy Central roast of Roseanne.
Yes.
In 2012. Mm-hmm. How'd you get that gig, and what was the,
she suggested me.
Yeah.
She asked that and we hadn't met before, so
really?
I was
you weren't
really
friends
honored.
Or anything.
No, and I really liked her. She was lovely, and the writers are so good, and mm-hmm. they wrote me some funny stuff, and it was one of those real fun things to do to honor her. And then at the end, the surprise guest was Tom Arnold. Came out, and they didn't even make eye contact, but it was pretty funny.
So I mean, you must have been kind of disappointed with everything that's gone on.
Not
with,
disappointed. I don't think she's well, and you know, that just makes me sad. I think mm-hmm. she's got, you know, she will tell you she's mentally ill. She's you know, and it's hard to, the hard thing is the people jumping on her, and that's tough.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's like, it's a disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Yeah. And the last one on my list here is acting opposite Meryl Streep in Julie and Julia, which
yes.
must have been a unique experience.
Yeah. Oh, I was so nervous. I was really thrilled, of course, to be asked to play, you know, Meryl Streep's sister and, you know, and work with Nora Ephron, too. Who's just an amazing person, and I miss her. She was so great, and I remember the first my first day of shooting, the day before my first day of shooting, Nora asked me to come to the set. She said, "I want you to see where Meryl is in terms of, you know, the character, what the world she's living in."
Mm-hmm.
And I had been working on it. And so I was like, oh, God, I hope it matches up, because, you know, they're big characters.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wonder how big she's going. And she was big. But that's what Julia Child was like. She not only was big physically, but she was effusive. Nothing was under, you know, she had passion, and her sister was that way as well.
Yeah.
And together, you know, the decibel levels go off the charts.
Yeah.
So when I saw what she did, and she said, you know, you see where you got to fit in here? And I said, yeah. So showed up the next, and after the first take, you know, and I'm doing my kind of with her, and you're hoping it doesn't just look like a bad SNL sketch. Like, I hope I don't look like Dan Aykroyd, who, you know, in that context was really funny. And Nora said, "I love what you're doing." So, it was such a relief.
That's great.
Oh my goodness! Look at that. All I think about all day is food, and then I dream about it all night.
Daughter, you have the brie.
Is this
the
brie?
Yes, that's it.
Is that not the most wonderful cheese you ever had in your life? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah, the two of you together in that movie are just fantastic.
Thank you.
Did she? I know in some films she kind of stays in character throughout. Was that the case here? Was she always Julia Child around you?
No, she didn't stay in character, but she, you know, in between takes, it wasn't like she was, you know, so, you know, what's going on? How are you? She very much stayed
very focused.
Yeah.
What did you learn about acting from acting with her?
Well, that it is about being, you know, kind of holding your focus and committing to your choices. And I kind of learned that how I'm going about it is the right way.
Because,
you know, you never really know. You know, I know I have my own process.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it does mean just kind of sitting there and not talking to anybody, just kind of containing myself. And that's what she does, too. So I wasn't at all offended that she wasn't like, so, you know, what are you doing tonight? She wasn't small talking. And she made big, big choices. And, you know, I sometimes make big, big choices depending, you know, if it's appropriate or not. But I love kind of taking things to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Like Sue Sylvester was extreme in another way
than
this character was. So it was really nice to see that she kind of did it. It's mostly the containment, I guess, that she would have in between takes. And I went, oh, she does it too. Good. So, because maybe I felt like the obligation to talk to people and it just kind of affirmed for me that it's okay the way I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the way that we end the show is that I ask guests, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? It can be just kind of the first thing that comes to mind, a movie, a TV show, something that people could check out.
Yeah.
Or just anything that you think of.
Fleabag.
Yeah.
I laughed like out loud and I watched it all in one sitting, mm-hmm. both seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, just I bow at the feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's amazing. Just amazing. I laughed so much. I laughed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That's stuff. Such a good show.
The sister, the girl who plays the sister,
yeah,
Claire.
Yeah, Claire.
Oh my God, isn't she hilarious? Don't look at my office. Don't say anything. It's not too big. She's so defensive, cutting everybody off at the pass, making sure they don't say what she doesn't want to hear.
Yeah.
Really good.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It was a lot of fun, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. Back at you.
Thanks again so much to Jane Lynch for coming out today. Hollywood Game Night is back every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on NBC, and she will be returning to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel for Season 3 later this year. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friend, share this episode, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.